Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, a family memoir of miraculous survival. It's been described by Robert Harris as epic, moving and powerful. Powerful and beautifully written, a modern classic by The Observer. From long-standing political columnist and commentator Daniel Finkelstein, a powerful memoir exploring both his mother and his father's devastating experience of persecution, resistance and survival during the Second World War. Delighted to be joining you once again on the show, live from the Palace of Westminster, the author of Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, Daniel Finkelstein. Daniel, good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning.
Good to have you with us. The title seems to be, if you think Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, it's almost sounds like it could be sort of a, I don't know, almost a sort of a trite kind of memoir, if you like, but it's very much not that. As with so many families who are now going back and discovering the privations and the unspeakable horrors that their families had to go through, this must have been both enlightening and cathartic, but also horrifying.
Yes, it was. And one of the reasons I use that title, actually, you're not wrong to think that it has a sort of light feel, is that I don't want people to feel that it's something that's so horrific they can't read it and they can't learn about it, because it's important that people should read this history. And it is an absorbing family story. And ultimately, it's uplifting. My parents were very happy people. They lived a long, happy life once they got to this country. But as I say at the beginning of the book, on the way, they had to take a detour through hell. And that's what I describe. Many people will, I suppose, know the story of the Holocaust, although my mother's version of the Holocaust story is completely extraordinary, with twists and turns that the reader will not anticipate. But they probably won't know the story of my father, the experience that people like his father had in the Gulag, the experience that he had of deportation into the wastelands of Kazakhstan and Siberia. So I tried to tell both these stories alongside each other, and that's why I've given it both a light title and one that involves the names and links the names inextricably of Stalin and Hitler.
Because it's important, isn't it, that people don't go, here we go, another story of the Holocaust, and make it trite, and many people won't, I suppose, be aware, because it was not covered up, but we didn't know what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, about the Gulag. Again, it's become this sort of, not trite, but oh yes, the Gulags. But your father, for escaping sort of the onslaught of the Nazis, then has to deal with the onslaught of Stalin.
So my mother's story is a sort of peculiar version of a story you'll have heard of. People will know about the Holocaust, and they probably have heard of Belsen, because British soldiers liberated Belsen. But the story of my mother is made unusual by the fact that she was the daughter of one of the leaders of German Jews, a man called Alfred Wiener, who had begun to campaign against the Nazis almost from the moment he came back from the First World War. So he first spoke out against the dangers of violent anti-Semitism in 1919. And eventually he starts a campaign going around the country, suing Nazis, collecting everything that they have to say, until he is faced up to by Goering, who tells him, when Goering becomes a Reich's minister, that he is going to have to destroy this archive. And he leaves Germany. Unfortunately, he only leaves as far as Holland. And in Holland, they're part of the same German Jewish refugee community as Anne Frank. My mother knew Anne Frank, and my aunt was in school with Margot. And they faced a sort of quite similar fate, whereas the Frank family hid, but ultimately ended up in Belsen. My family ended up in Belsen because they didn't hide. So, you know, lots of people, whatever they did, ended up in the same position. So this is a story in which they then get released from Belsen only because they have a Paraguayan passport. And it's an extraordinary story about how a group of Poles created passports that allowed Jews to be swapped. And in the end, only 136 people are ever swapped. And my mother is one of them, all those millions of people. So you can see that's why I use miraculous story among the millions who died. But my father's story actually is a fairly standard version of a story you just don't know about. He was born in Lviv, which is, as it's now known.
Yeah.
And the Germans invade, as you say, Giles, from one end of Poland, and my father hears the bombing of the Germans, and then the Soviets come in. At first they think the Soviets are coming in to save them, but in fact the Soviets had a deal with the Nazis, and they came in to capture Lviv.
Can I just stop you, though, because you said Lviv. And for people who don't know, because I think the more that we're discovering, as people are understanding what's going on in Ukraine now, the more that you discovered Lviv and how what a centre of arts and culture is. But it's basically been sort of only now we're rediscovering how important that was, because as Philippe Sands said, who is the international human rights lawyer, famously said that when he was looking at his family, who only his grandfather survived of Lviv, of 80 of his family members, and his wife famously said, if you went to the cinema in Swiss Cottage, you put your hand up and said, my grandfather was from Lviv, about half of the cinema would say yes, mine was too. But it really was a flourishing centre. And when you get people like Hans Frank going there, who is the Gauleiter of Poland, and he celebrates Otto Wächter by saying, "Congratulations, you've got rid of the flat-footed people," meaning the Jews from Lviv.
Well, that's completely correct. And interestingly, one of the people, obviously, who'd stick their hand up in the Swiss Cottage cinema would be me. And Philippe Sands and I were in the same school, and we knew each other. We were cordial. But only when he began to write his family history and I began to write mine, we both realized that we were from the Landis family of Lviv. In other words, that we are third cousins.
Wow. And
so here we are, two cordial but otherwise strangers. We're now actually close. And one of the people who very much helped me with this book was Philippe. He took me to my grandfather's home in Lviv, and I went to Lviv in the months just before the war began, and was able to visit my grandfather's home with Philippe. So, yes, there are, coming from there is quite common.
Can I just ask you another question? Did you go to the synagogue then in Lviv?
Well, we went to what remains of the various synagogues, yes. And my grandfather belonged to something, my father belonged to something called the Tempel in Lviv, and that was razed to the ground. So I couldn't go to my father's synagogue, but we did go to many of the remaining Jewish places, which still stand, which are not many.
So your father then is as you said, the Soviets come through, and in many, and so it's hardly being liberated, because he finds himself arrested and then sentenced to hard labor, and that is pretty much a sentence of death, surely.
It does. Well, for my grandfather, absolutely. He was 50 years old, and his job is to pull logs to the water, having walked for 2 hours through, snow that comes up to the top of your leg. So really is a death sentence, the idea of eight years in doing that. And my father was, who's 10 years old at this time, sent to a state collective farm in the Kazakhstan-Siberia borders. And I'm able to tell the story of his life there. I found correspondence to help me to do that, and my father also gave testimony. So one of the things that really was striking, they had no fuel, and therefore inside it was below freezing. I think that people, as I say, they'll be familiar with the story from the concentration camps. Nobody can ever get used to it, but they will at least know it. But this is a story I don't think they will know.
And this an idea of the deprivations that he was going through was the fact that he had to build his own, should we call it house, hut? What do you want to call it? Explain a little bit about what he did.
So first they have to stay in a, you can hear that I'm in Westminster, can't you?
Absolutely,
by the way, what a country we live in, that I'm able to tell you this story of my refugee parents. And while I'm telling you this story, you can hear the bongs of Big Ben. That's the country we live in, and isn't that amazing? My father lived in a hut that had been built out of cow dung. That was what they had to live in. They'd first of all lived in a sort of cattle shed, but then the cattle needed to come in. It was winter, and they had to build out of adobe bricks. And it's not unknown for people to live in those things, but my grandmother, let's put it this way, she may have been tough, she may have been intelligent, but she was no architect or farmer. They eventually, the porch of their building collapsed, and somebody had to sort of come and create a hole which they could crawl in and out of. And the first thing that happens is that one of their, the six of them that are living in there, dies in horrendous pain of, you know, some disease probably caught from, you know, from all the dirt in their surroundings. So horrendous experience, and probably would have led my father to die if Hitler had not invaded the Soviet Union.
So how do, you know... When do they both? I mean, the Paraguayan passport is something I'd never heard of. Just thank you for bringing that to my attention. And how does your father A, survive, and B, when he is released, presumably does he is he given the option to get out of yes. Soviet Union?
So when the amnesty comes that's caused by Hitler invading the Soviet Union, there's an amnesty for Poles. Some of the Poles don't leave the gulag or the state collective farm because where were they going to go? They weren't given any money, and they weren't given any food, and they were miles from anywhere. My father and his mother were 4 days by horse and cart from the nearest small town, they actually took the risk of going there because they wanted to see whether they could be reunited with my grandfather, not realizing that actually the rest of the family had been told my grandfather was no longer alive. So they united with each with other people in Semipalatinsk. But you can see they were just absolutely miles from anywhere. In the end, they are able to link up with the Polish Free Army that Stalin allowed to be created, and they go from there to Iran. From Iran to Iraq, from Iran and Iraq to Palestine. Some of the from Polish Free Army go to Italy, but my family came to London with the Polish Resettlement Corps.
And how do you rebuild your life at this point? Because they've seen things, and they've been through experiences that would break most people and leave what we'd call now PTSD.
Yeah, I open the book actually with that question. I think it's, you know, and you put your finger on it as usual, Giles. I think that it really was a matter of willpower on their part. My parents were determined that they were going to live life, not merely survive. My mother was for a book written by photographs by a man called Harry Borden, a wonderful book called Survivors. She was asked to have a photograph and then write a few words about herself, and she said, I'm a person and a wife and a mother first, and a teacher, and only then a survivor. And both my parents were determined to put living life in this country for themselves and their children above their right to claim victimhood, even though they had been a victim. And they were never worried about teaching people about the Holocaust or about my father's experience, though no one ever asked my father about his experience, by the way. My mother did schools and went to Downing Street and did radio programs. People asked her about the Holocaust the whole time, but no one ever asked my dad about Stalin. I'm sure for many readers, this will be the first time they've read about it. So, but they were very open to talk about it. But what they weren't going to do was relive it. When I said to you, there are the chimes of Big Ben. My mother felt very strongly that's what we should be doing with our life, getting on, living it, being part of this country. And all three of her children have done precisely that.
And I suppose, in a way, the timing of this book couldn't be more prescient, because we're now in a situation where certain aspects of political history in the former Soviet Union are being rewritten or ignored or even snubbed out.
While I was sending the proofs back to the publisher, I turned on the radio and a bomb had fallen on Lviv. And I think one of the reasons that's happened is because while the Germans had to face their history because of what happened to them, they lost the war and they were forced to face what they'd done in the past. The Soviets never had to do that. Now Putin is interested in reasserting the legacy of Stalin. You go to Moscow and you can see the grave of Stalin still. So, or at least, the monument to him. I think that is, that's definitely very pertinent. But there's another reason, which is closer to home, that I wrote this book. you know, my mother and father have just died, and I thought it was necessary their stories didn't die with them. And the reason I thought it was necessary is because you can see around the world the rise of populism in all the countries, you know, many countries in Europe, and in the United States, from Hungary to Turkey to Donald Trump. And it's necessary to warn people of the dangers of abandoning pluralism and the rule of law in favor of dictatorships or great leaders who don't have much concern for the truth.
And also, not only that, but it's you get people who are making broad brushstrokes and saying, well, these people or those people or these immigrants. And yet, when it comes down to it, it's a story of families and people and, yeah, and tradition. And the more, and we lose that. We demonize and we dehumanize people at our peril.
Yeah. Look, and Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, my book, really tries to make that point without lecturing people. So my decision all along was, I'm just going to tell their story. It's going to be human and absorbing and compelling, and you're going to wonder what happens next, and you're going to be engaged with the people. It's, I didn't want to write a polemic. There are plenty of those. I write them for a living, and I enjoy writing them. They have their place, but that's not what this is. This is a story, and it's a storybook. And I spent an awful lot of time making sure that every bit of truth was there. I made sure that readers, nothing ever happens to my character that the reader doesn't understand. In other words, I try to explain the context, the history, how the political decisions were made. But what I don't do is then say, we should do this, we should do that, because that's for the reader to determine once they've read it. But, you know, I don't disagree with your conclusion.
The book is called Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, a family memoir of miraculous survival. It's by Daniel Finkelstein, who is speaking to today. Daniel, if people want to find you online, I know you Twitter and tweet because we have spoken about this before, but where can people find you online?
Danny the Fink, or they can find me, obviously, at The Times. So, right, you said I've got a column in today if you're interested.
Marvellous. Once again, it's been great to have you on the show, and no doubt we'll get, go and write something else so we can get you back on the show, Danny, because I always enjoy talking to you. The book is called Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, a family memoir of miraculous survival. It's by Daniel Finkelstein. Daniel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on.